All right, time to wrap up the week here. Only doing 4 episodes today since I'm traveling today. We'll just leave it in because, you know, I'm Jade Hoyt. Only doing 4 episodes this week because I am traveling tomorrow back to the home office. Danny is here. Got to catch up on some news. We talked a little bit in the over-unders, but it got some stuff that we couldn't really fit in there very well. And then we want to talk about our breakout and regression candidates for this year and finally get to our best bets, which we didn't have a chance to do yet on the over-under podcast. So, Danny, what do we got here for news?
Well, I think the place to start is not with something that happened recently, but something that is important, which is Philly finally replacing Brian Colangelo and hiring Elton Brand as their general manager. And it seems like he's pretty closely connected with Brett Brown. And so I've heard speculation that Brown will still have a pretty significant voice in the process. That is something that some coaches have and some coaches do not have. But Philadelphia, because they basically rolled over their space to next year. Talent evaluation, recruitment, all of that is incredibly important because they are a team with an incredibly high ceiling. And so what they do with the space they have and who they prioritize in the draft and everything else is big for the league.
Yeah, and they have that asset as well going forward, that 2021 Miami unprotected pick that looks like it might be kind of juicy. They're always in the market to try and add another star as well. So yeah, this is one of the premier GM spots in the league, and it was a meandering search, to say the least, to the extent that you can meander when you don't actually interview that many people for a very long time. There's really no understanding of why they didn't interview people on other teams until the very end of this process. It seemed like there wasn't necessarily a huge push to do that. Then there was speculation that we're going to kind of go into the season with the status quo and then see if we can get one of the big superstar guys next summer, and then if not, go with an internal candidate. But it does seem like now with Brand, certainly someone who played to rave reviews during his NBA career for his intelligence and integrity, and had only been working for a very short time in the Sixers organization, had only retired really 2 years ago. You remember he was brought in by the Colangelos to kind of fix their culture after all the Jahlil Okafor problems and Sam Hinkie getting not fired as of that time, but superseded, shall we say. But certainly you have to question someone bringing in, as in theory, the lead decision maker, someone with so little experience, especially when the process, ironically enough, did not appear to be a normal one as far as the GMs are.
Yeah, that's certainly fair. And we'll see how Brand works. There have been, you know, more people who do not have a ton of experience that have worked out well as GMs. There are those who really, really have not. So it's a big time. Like, he's going to have to hit the ground running, not necessarily for this season, but going into next year. It's going to be important. Another smaller piece of Sixers news, Jared Bayless, who I'm sure a lot of people are surprised is still on the Sixers. Bayless had a sprain of his left knee. He'll be reevaluated in 3 to 4 weeks. And there is a possibility that they just at some point clear the roster spot, but I think they probably have him on board now more for filler salary and then depth. It's good to have depth guards too.
Yeah, I mean, if you really look at their depth chart right now with Bayless out, there's some talk that Landry Shamet could get some time, or Landry Shamet, I think, actually. That's another one where I think you screwed me up when I had it right, and then you were like, oh, is that what it is? Or but anyway, maybe it is Shamet, who knows? But I think it's Landry Shamet, and they're talking about him maybe even being in the rotation after a strong couple of preseason games, but they do need some shooting with Wilson Chandler out and Bayless, as you mentioned. Somewhat worrying that Jonathan Isaac in a preseason game against Philadelphia suffered a right ankle sprain. This one is supposedly day-to-day, but also troublesome that is the same ankle that cost him most of last season a year ago. And, you know, hopefully this does not become a chronic thing for Isaac. As we mentioned, there's talk that he might start at the 3 in Orlando. That could slow down that push to some degree. In New York, Porzingis doesn't appear to be on the fast end of his timetable. He has not even been cleared yet to sprint, and usually sprinting is something that comes a little earlier by my recollection than 7 months after an ACL tear, because, you know, that's in a straight line. It's really the side-to-side stuff that stresses the ACL out more, the jumping stuff. So if he's not even running in a straight line yet at a sprint, that would seem to mean he is on a very conservative timetable there. And also So this is a while ago, but something that must be mentioned. Mark Berman reported this over the summer that Ron Baker, despite a guaranteed $4 million contract, could even get cut from this team, which, you know, I would support. It's a sunk cost. He wasn't signed to that ridiculous contract by this administration. Man, those last days of Phil Jackson sure destroyed this team. But, doesn't look like Baker is going to figure in the Knicks' plans despite their relative inexperience at the guard position.
Yeah, he did play a little bit in, I can't even remember who they were playing in the game I watched on, it was Monday. Something else that was troubling for me on the injury kind of recovery front, CJ McCollum had a PRP injection during the offseason. From the reporting that I saw, it doesn't look like it's going to linger into this year, but, you know, any kind of time a guy has a procedure and, you know, you kind of think about it. And the other part of this, we've talked about this in the over-unders a little bit, is that the Blazers' key players have stayed really healthy over the last few years. That has allowed them to exceed maybe their expectations, their projections, because they haven't had to deal with that. And so anything that makes that less likely is something that I'm going to consider.
Yeah, and you can always take these injury news one of two ways. Sometimes when a guy just doesn't play that well, I thought CJ quietly was a little bit below his normal standard last year. If there's an injury explanation, sometimes that can make you feel a little bit better about it, especially if it's something that's relatively minor, as this appears to be. Probably the biggest news that we have to discuss, though, is the signing of Anthony Davis with Rich Paul and Clutch Sports. And woe be it for us to be one of these sky is falling. He's not going to stay in this small market where he has no chance of winning a championship. Oh, wait, no, that's exactly what we do all the time, because that happens all the time. And certainly you cannot interpret this as a positive sign for New Orleans. Rich Paul saying, oh, this doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to leave when he was asked about it. But you don't hire Rich Paul so you can just sign on the dotted line on that designated player veteran extension when you know for sure that you're going to be offered that. You know, Davis is already eligible with two straight All-NBA teams to get that next summer. And we've talked about how, you know, I think we might be a little more optimistic on New Orleans than the conventional wisdom this season, but then they're going to have real trouble, even if they do play well this year, re-signing Nikola Mirotic, Julius Randle, and Elfrid Payton, if those guys end up being the key to them exceeding expectations this year. And even so, I mean, at the highest level of expectations, it doesn't seem like New Orleans is a championship contender. And as we've talked about ad nauseum, because of moves that were made way back in the formative years of Davis's career, really has no path to getting into championship contention. And we've seen a number of players, carrot of that designated player veteran extension or no, decide that they are going to move on. And, you know, Giannis is the next guy in that watch now. And we're always, you know, a couple of years ahead of these things, but, you know, these are organizational issues. And then the other interesting thing is, if Davis does end up wanting to get moved, who's going to make that decision in New Orleans? Is it going to be Gail Benson, Tom Benson's widow? Is it going to be Mickey Loomis, the football executive? They don't really deal with these things in football where, you know, they've got the franchise tag there and they can just slap that on ad nauseum. So, you know, he might try and play hardball with Davis, or, you know, is it going to be Dell Dumps, who also, you know, I think has done a better job over these last couple of years, but is not supposed to be the easiest guy to deal with necessarily either. So a lot of intrigue there, but if you're a Pelicans fan, you already had to be really worried, and certainly this is not a great sign.
Another part of that, though this is less relevant for AD possibly, is that Rich Paul clients have been more willing to do high wire acts in terms of negotiation. I mean, Tristan Thompson was the last player before somebody we're going to talk about recently to basically go past the qualifying offer deadline
KCP
with Tristan Thompson.
Yeah.
KCP, Eric Bledsoe had a long acrimonious negotiation with the Phoenix Suns. Like, a lot of these happen to be with Rich Paul. And with AD, it's not the situation of maximizing the money, because he will get whatever is, you know, like whatever is the most any team can offer, he will get that offer. And so it's a very different kind of negotiation. But to me, the tendency to push that lever is probably pretty similar to if AD wants to be somewhere else, and I'm not saying he does, I'm not saying he should, that willing to push the levers necessary to make that happen. And I think this is also, like, this is going to have, to me, bigger ripple effects throughout the league in terms of the willingness of certain other teams, and I think Boston is probably the most prominent among these, to make other moves, because Anthony Davis, if he becomes available in a trade, is the best player available in a trade in a long time. My instinct, I mean, because Kawhi is different due to the injury concerns. I mean, Kawhi at his best is better than Davis has been, but I'd say we're probably in, like, James Harden when he was on the Thunder type of territory here. And Davis is more proven than Harden was at that point. And so if that is a possibility, and if the possibility is larger now than it was before he changed agents, that affects the league.
Yeah, actually, I would say in terms of the performance that he had shown prior to the trade, the comparable player is Dwight Howard, who, remember, I mean, had been a top five player in the NBA for 4 or 5 years before he was traded to the Lakers. As it turned out, he had that back surgery, and while he did have moments in Houston, never really was quite the same player, especially on the defensive end, and even offensively as well. But a little other Pelicans news as well. Jahlil Okafor, who remember signed for only $50,000 guaranteed, had a couple of nice moves going against Wendell Carter in that game against the Bulls, and then suffered an ankle injury. It looked pretty bad, but it's supposedly 1 to 2 weeks. And for Okafor, I think there appeared to be a path for him to make the Pelicans. Part of that depends on what happens with Alexi Ajinsa, who had knee surgery over the summer, still hasn't been cleared for contact. He's been doing some player development stuff. There was some thought that maybe he could get a medical retirement, but you know, it looks like he is trying to work his way back, so that may not happen. But with him in the last year of his contract, he basically is salary fodder, isn't going to figure in the Pel's plans this year, so maybe if they move on from him, that gives Okafor a better shot at a roster slot. And so I think Okafor could still potentially make this team, although with Randall, Mirotić, Cheick Diallo all in theory ahead, you know, he's looking more like a fifth big man and not necessarily a guy who can come in and play a role. You know, he's more a guy you throw it to get some offense, perhaps, rather than, you know, a plug-and-play type of big man at the end of your roster.
We'll move to Dallas, where Dirk Nowitzki looks like he's questionable to start the regular season, per Tim McMahon. And the last that came out was, I think it was a couple days ago, when they were going to China, which they're going to play, I think, on Friday morning is the first game there, that it will be weeks, not days, before Nowitzki gets back. And Dirk said that, Rick Carlisle said that. And so it was already semi-announced or expected that Dirk was not going to be an opening night starter, that they were going to transition him into a different role. But this injury could affect, you know, getting the balance right at the beginning of the season, to be sure.
In Denver, Gary Harris has been sitting out, but that's supposedly precautionary. Same thing with Jamal Murray, suffering an ankle injury. They didn't play against the Lakers on Tuesday night. But more interesting, no timetable at all as camp starts for Michael Porter Jr. Rampant speculation even before he had that second back surgery that he might just sit out the entire year. And then Jared Vanderbilt, the other talented player they drafted, coming off a foot surgery, he is not practicing yet either and does not have any kind of a timetable that's been announced.
And so that's going to put more pressure on their active players, depending on even what they do with two-way spots, because Isaiah Thomas is still out as well. So Monty Morris is going to be taking a role, but and they have enough depth. I mean, I was happy to see Juancho Hernangómez actually look pretty good in limited minutes against both of the Lakers games.
I'm skeptical about whether they have a they certainly don't have enough proven depth, I would say, but
that's fair.
They do have options and young players with pedigree who could come through, but that remains to be seen whether they can or not.
Speaking of a lack of proven depth, Chicago's guard rotation is a little bit weaker right now because Denzel Valentine is out a couple weeks with an ankle tweak, and it's not the first time he's had those issues. And then something that I'm kind of filtering in the back of my mind, Omer Asik is out indefinitely with inflammatory arthritis, which might be related to his Crohn's disease. And Asik, not a huge part of the Bulls' plans, but this could kind of parallel Mirza Teletovic, who the Bucks wanted to come back, but he actually recently retired, in that if Asik can't play, instead of just having to spread out the money remaining on the final year of his contract, I believe this year is pretty much spoken for, they could get a injury exclusion for that, and then it would be a little bit cleaner for the Bulls clearing cap space next summer.
Yeah, and Asik, for some reason, I guess tanking purposes, they played him in 4 games down the end of the season.
Oh yeah, I wanted to mention that, because if they hadn't played him during those games, a lot of the timing on injury-related exclusions is about 1 year after the last time they played. If he didn't play in those games, I think it would have been early in this season that they could have applied for an exclusion.
The last game he had played before that was on January 30th with the Pels, right before that trade. I don't really understand why the Pels traded him either. Although, hilariously, in a game against Sacramento, he played...
Well, he was filler in the mirror team.
Right, no, I understand that, but I'm saying, like, if you're the Pels, why were you trading him, like, or playing him? Why weren't you sort of just hoping that we don't play him and then, you know, this medical thing happens? But I guess he was healthy enough to play. He actually played 24 minutes in his last game before the trade to Chicago. Maybe they're trying to prove he was healthy or something. But other than that, he didn't play more than 18 minutes all season. And so we'll see what happens with him. He does have $3 million or so guaranteed for next year. At this point, we started the season, so getting the cap space for this season, you know, was never really going to happen anyway. But yeah, I mean, they certainly would be wise to not play him at all this year and get some salary relief. But in theory, with them trying to use cap space next year, we're talking about a $1 million difference. The thought would be that they would stretch him next year and spread that $3 million over 3 years. So not a major issue either way, except for cap dorks like us. In Brooklyn, Shaz Napier, pulled his hamstring last week. He doesn't have a timetable yet from what I've seen, but that is not particularly, double check that. Yeah, still not practicing, and hamstrings can be tricky. This is another one of those spate of hamstring injuries that happened early in camp. Another of those, Milos Teodosic, another kind of overuse type of injury. He's not back yet either. And with that Clippers backcourt being such a war, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander supposedly looking good early in camp, you could see Teo falling out of the rotation. The concern about him always was, hey, is he going to be able to hold up physically in the NBA? So far, the answer to that has been no. And certainly, I think Teo, if he does get healthy, could be a trade candidate. The question just becomes, what's the price? Because certainly not anything close to a first round pick for him. But you think if he can get back on the court, he might look good in, say, a Phoenix or Orlando uniform. Those are the two teams that probably have the biggest holes at point guard and are, in theory, trying to go for it and play well, at least early in the season. You just wrote about this. So you want to bring us up to date on the Patrick McCaw situation?
Yeah, this is interesting and bizarre. There's also some reporting from Anthony Slater of The Athletic, which is worth, I'll mention some of it. But so basically the way that qualifying offers work, we focus a lot on the early deadline in July, where basically it can be, a qualifying offer can be unilaterally revoked by a team as long as it hasn't yet been signed by a player through, there's a point in mid-July, I think it's July 13th off the top of my head. And then at that point, then you can do it with both the player and the team kind of turning their keys at the same time. That actually happened with the Bucks and Jabari Parker this summer. But the one that doesn't get talked about much, because it doesn't happen very often, is that if the qualifying offer runs all the way through to October 1st, then basically it can come off the board unless the team chooses to keep it on the board. And what that does, like, you go, oh, well, that could be interesting for the player. Well, no, it isn't, because for the player, there's still a restricted free agent. Like, Patrick McCaw is still a restricted free agent, but that, in his case, $1.7 million qualifying offer is not on the table anymore. So the reporting that Slater has out there is that McCaw's representation wanted him to sign that offer, and then the only other thing that was on the table that we know of was the Warriors offering a two-year, $5 million offer, but the second year was non-guaranteed. So that's actually even more favorable for the Warriors, because they could lock him in at a friendly price. And he didn't want either of those options, so the question that I've been getting a lot is, well, what the hell happens now? And the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah, and some more troubling reporting from Slater in there. Not troubling necessarily, but not great when it's getting out there that his representation recommended he do something and that he decided against it. I mean, you wonder, like, who's telling him that? Is that the agent? Like, that's a little weird. You know, I don't think you want that getting out there. If you're the agent, I mean, maybe that's kind of behavior that's, like, good for the agent, but not good for the player, you know? And it sounds like his father is becoming more involved in the process and that he wants more playing time. Although, frankly, I think he could play more with the Warriors, although the idea is that he wants to, like, have a larger role in terms of having the ball in his hands more. But I mean, no one's going to give that to him at this point with any kind of a guarantee. And it doesn't sound like he has much of an offer out there. Now, if I were another team that had, say, part of my room exception left, remember every offer sheet has to be 2 years, although it doesn't have to be fully guaranteed necessarily, but you can't have an option. It's got to be at least 2 years. The Warriors offering that 2 year, $5 million deal, but the second year, either non-guaranteed or a team option. We've seen reporting on that either way. And so, I mean, I think I probably would just go back to the Warriors if I were McCaw, but if I were another team, I don't think there's offers out there. You know, I might be willing to offer McCaw a 2 year, $6 million offer sheet just based on what he flashed in his rookie year. Just like, again, we've talked about this, guys who have the talent on the wing to be good players on both ends. He certainly didn't show it last year. He struggled with injuries, but he showed it in his rookie year. Like, those guys need to get more chances. Even if there's only a 25% chance that they come through, you need to, if you're a team that needs help on the wing, give guys like that a shot just based on the low probability that they might come through and really be a valuable player for you. So that's that situation. Don't see it getting resolved anytime soon necessarily. In Indiana, Thad Young is yet to participate in practice with a bruised foot. That is not good. They really need him the defensively, although this could lead to seeing a lot more of Sabonis and Miles Turner together. I'm not a believer that that combination really is going to work as well as the Pacers think it will, although with those guys both being young and no power forward of the future on the roster outside of Sabonis, it does make sense to try it. I don't think it's going to go too well. What else we got here?
Owner of the Houston Rockets, Tillman Fertitta, he talked with Jonathan Fagan of the Houston Chronicle about the luxury tax.
Yeah, and I think it was actually a press conference that he had pretty early on. Yeah.
It might have been a press conference that Fagan recapped. Yeah. That could very well be. I was thinking about his piece. And so it was really interesting. Like there was kind of the bridge that he was trying to cover of like, basically the tax is really burdensome and you don't want to pay the repeater tax, but they're not going to shy away from paying the tax to the right team. But really what this does for me is it flies in the face of what they were saying before of, oh, we're not even talking about the luxury tax, because when one of the options on the table is bringing back Trevor Ariza on a 1-year contract at a price that is commensurate with his value in the league, absent the luxury tax part of it, you are considering the luxury tax. And so, I mean, it's good to have what we said be basically kind of informally confirmed, but it is a concern because championship windows are always narrow. And whenever teams get a little bit cute, teams get a little bit cheap, it can have real consequences. And this one, you know, their downgrades at various positions this offseason are more significant to me than like Miami using the amnesty provision on Mike Miller, let's say.
Yeah, and we'll see. You know, maybe Daryl Morey can cobble it together. But certainly Fertitta's comments to McMahon, which were made at Summer League, probably, you know, in the pit of despair, as Ethan talked about, where everyone schmoozes, you know, you can kind of get interviews. And I think McMahon probably just went up to him and he wasn't really prepared to have a party line on these comments. But he said, oh, we haven't talked about the luxury tax one time in a meeting. Well, certainly these comments, and that was always completely ridiculous for him to say that, because their moves were clearly made with the tax in mind. They've done a great job getting Capella for as cheaply as they did, minimizing the tax bill this year. They've done a fantastic job. But nonetheless, it does seem like they are very focused on that, especially when this is the first year they'll be paying the tax. The repeater tax is 4 years away from now, potentially. And granted, Chris Paul has a 4-year contract, so it's something they might have to deal with. And the other thing that he says, oh, I'm happy to pay the luxury tax. And then he had this joke, but you know, these jokes have some truth to it sometimes, like, well, if we're paying the tax and we're not a championship contender, I'll find myself a new GM. You know, it's just kind of like, you know, just some of the things that have been happening here with Fertitta bears a little watching, that, you know, he may not be quite the owner that Leslie Alexander was in terms of the Rockets' fortunes, but they have Daryl Morey. They had all these players already when he came in, so it's going to be hard for him to screw it up. But I do wonder a little bit, and especially that he doesn't seem like the absolute easiest guy to work for. Seems like he's got a little bit of an ego. Seems like he doesn't have that much money compared to a lot of NBA owners. And so, you know, 2-3 years ago from now, when the Rockets kind of start to fall off, you know, just keep an eye on maybe Morey moving on. We'll see. That's just a very vague prediction. We're probably going to totally forget about it 3 years from now, but just kind of a feeling at the back of my head. Also, Joe Chi has missed the start of camp with an ankle.
We should also mention that on a Miami standpoint, James Johnson is still not cleared for contact after that May hernia surgery that he had. And Josh Richardson has missed both of their preseason games with a thigh bruise. And I kind of did a tweet at that with a lot when Ira Winderman said that he was out. And I believe Bam didn't play in their last game as well. I cannot speak to the severity of it, but it is also true that if you are if you were to be in negotiations on a player, then you were happy with kind of where the terms were, you would probably not want that, not the your side of that negotiation to be playing in meaningless preseason game.
And you would imagine that Josh Richardson would have to be part of any Jimmy Butler trade. Let me ask you this, Danny, real quickly, would you trade, I mean, assuming that some relatively insignificant salary could be found to help match it, would you trade Josh Richardson essentially straight up for Jimmy Butler? Who's more valuable right now?
Well, I think that Richardson's contract is better than Jimmy Butler is on this one and next one.
Right. So 4 years, $42 million. That's just starting million right now.
So like he's better on that contract, but what Jimmy Butler does is he gives you kind of a jolt. Like Josh Richardson is a player that makes what you have better, and Jimmy Butler's an ability to kind of elevate your plane. And if, you know, I wasn't excited about where Miami was, you know, like that sort of situation, I'm far more okay with making that sort of a move by going a little bit bigger. And, you know, maybe Jimmy Butler resigns, maybe he doesn't, depending on how this year goes. I could could see him being a great fit with their culture. So I probably would do it, but it's, you know, I understand the risks involved, and I could understand that you might disagree with that, because I think you're even higher on Richardson than I am.
Yeah, you can certainly make the argument that a young guy like Richardson doesn't have many miles on him. Four more years at a below average starter level, solid 3-and-D guy, can guard a lot of threes, maybe not all of them, but that he's more valuable than Butler, who certainly looks to be better this year, but he's going to be 30, and then is going to require, even if he does re-sign, a five-year contract that is going to end up being pretty awful. But I think, you know, it depends on where you are as an organization, but certainly I think a very interesting question. Couple more things. Lonzo Ball played 4-on-4, has played a little bit of 5-on-5 in camp, but has not played yet in the preseason. And J.R. Smith suffering from hip soreness. He hasn't practiced in full yet either, and he's in a competition with some players on the wing in Cleveland, possible, especially with them in a little more of a building mode, that he could be out of the rotation. And frankly, he's played really poorly these last few years, but at least had the chemistry with LeBron James, and now they don't have that reason to play him anymore. And then in Atlanta, Justin Anderson had shin surgery in June to deal with some shin splints. He is not cleared yet. He's going to be reevaluated early in October. And then Dwayne Dedmon dealing with an avulsion fracture in his ankle. Not as bad as it might sound with the fracture. An avulsion fracture is basically a little piece of bone on the end of your ligament gets kind of pulled off the rest of the bone when you sprain your ankle. And so, you know, it's basically just a little bit of a complication with the ankle sprain. Supposedly not serious, but interesting with their big man rotation. Alex Len could get a little bit more time now. Maybe we'll see some more John Collins at center, which I hope, rather than at the four. By the way, did you see that awesome Trae Young pass off the backboard in traffic to John Collins for a dunk the other day? That was fantastic.
That was nasty. I mean, and good to get a reminder for people who think of Trae Young just as a shooter that he's also a very intuitive and good passer. And just as a broad point, you and I have talked about this at various moments on the live show and on the podcast. I feel like players in general should use the backboard more. Like this was the LeBron passing it off the backboard to himself when he got stuck. Aaron Gordon actually had a really nice one last year as well. That's a different kind of thing, but generally speaking, it just adds kind of, if you want to think about it, to the geometry of the floor. It's just angles and other options that guys should use as often as they can.
All right, we got to get to our breakout and regression candidate, but first this from Ancestry. The leading consumer DNA test. With Ancestry, you'll learn a more complete story of you. My sister-in-law actually tried it and found out some pretty interesting stuff about their family. They're half Chinese, but found out that actually more than 50% of their ancestry was Asian. Their dad is actually, they thought, pretty much Irish, but then it turned out he had a bunch of Viking blood as well. So they were really very interested to see. I'm waiting on the results of my test right now. I'm Jewish, got a lot of kind of murky Eastern European blood with that. So I'm very interested to see how that ends up turning out. I always consider myself a European mutt is what I would tell people. So interested in finally getting, you know, we know our history pretty well for when we get to the US, but before that, don't really know it that well. Why go with Ancestry? Well, you can find your origins in more than 350 regions around the world and 2 times greater geographic detail than any other DNA test. They've got the largest online collection of family history records, and this can really magnify your DNA results for more insight into your genealogy and origins. I've actually taken the test. I just haven't gotten my results yet. It's just incredibly easy. Just fill up a tube with some saliva and send it over to them. The way to get started, ancestry.com/capspace gets you 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/capspace is that URL to get 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/capspace. Use that URL and let them know that came from us. All right, so I think we'll come up with maybe 4 each in the breakout and regression category. So why don't you give us a start here, Danny?
Sure. So for me, I like to think about breakout guys in terms of improvement, like just being better basketball players, opportunity, or both. And so Victor Oladipo is a good guy to think about here. I mean, last year's most improved player, not a precedent because he's just, that was such a ridiculous thing. Kevin Pelton wrote a nice piece on this that you can read if you want to. But he had the opportunity by getting the ball in his hands more, not playing with Russell Westbrook. He was a way better basketball player. So he did both. And so the first guy I want to talk about, I have no idea if he's going to be a better basketball player, but James Ennis gets to be in the funhouse mirror now. And that means getting much better shots. That means a system that I think will do well for him defensively. Their switch heavy scheme will make him look good. And just as a point of reference, James Ennis's career highs in full season. So that's, I think I drew it at like 60 games or more in a season. An 11.6 PER, 588 true shooting, which is actually a pretty high number. He might not blow that away or anything. 7.1 points per game and 4 rebounds per game. And then I didn't even get into his three-point shooting and stuff. I'm sure he'll blow through those numbers as well. So I just think people are going to realize that he's a very good basketball player and a wonderful fit for this Houston Rockets team. So even though you and I have been high on him for a while, he seems like the most obvious example to me.
Yeah, one reason to pump the brakes on him is it looks like Eric Gordon may actually start for them over Ennis, which is a surprise to me now, and that they'll leave P.J. Tucker in the starting lineup. We'll see, however, whether that ends up happening. It could be, and he has been playing to rave reviews early in camp. He certainly was on my list as well as a possibility. I think that's one with the situation, and I think defensively he's someone who has been a little bit better than, at least by my eye test, than, you know, kind of his reputation was coming in. I'm going to start with a second-year player, Jared Allen. I think has looked very good in his limited summer league run, just has so much length, plays hard, is able to switch on the perimeter. You know, I think it's possible that he could have a Clint Capella type of breakout. He doesn't have quite that level of explosion around the basket, but I think he actually can be a better shot blocker than Capella, better traditional rim-protecting instincts than Capella, and also just a really exciting player. I mean, he goes up to try and dunk everything around the rim. Zach Lowe had this stat that he really protects the rim when he's in the area per the second spectrum cameras about as well as anyone in the league. So I'm really looking forward to seeing him. He has a clear path towards playing time here with Houston, or I'm sorry, with Ennis, with Brooklyn. You know, he's got Ed Davis behind him, Kenneth Faried maybe as a backup center, but clearly the thought is that he is the center of the future, drafted 22nd overall a couple years ago, and I think he might be, as we talked about on the East Overunders, their best chance of getting a guy who's going to be an average or above starter. And I think other than strength, I am hopeful that he's not going to have too many holes in his game. Even with took a corner three, looked okay shooting that in summer league. So I think he could really experience a breakout if he gets enough playing time, and he's on track to do that this season.
I like that you included Allen. He actually was basically my top honorable mention guy, so I'm really happy you brought him up. Part of the reason why he made that list instead of my breakouts is that when I looked at the numbers, he actually played better last year than I remembered. It was just that the sample was smaller, right, just with the way it worked out. And so that was a little bit different for me. I'll go to somebody who did not play well last year, and that's Dennis Smith. This will be Dennis Smith's age 21 season. And I might be a year early on this. It happens sometimes where it's like you like a guy, but but he was one of the most destructive players in the league last year, trying to do too much on a Dallas team that was just, they just weren't all the way there. They also got killed in crunch time, so they didn't perform. And one of the things that I fixated on was the balance that Dennis Smith had last year between catch and shoot threes and pull-up threes. So last year he shot 37% on catch and shoots, 27% on pull-ups, but he shot more pull-ups than catch, right, and shoot. And Luka Doncic being there, so the proxy I did was that if you switch Dennis Smith's proportions of those two things to what Jamal Murray had last year, which was 60-40, as opposed to, you know, more like 40-60 the other way, then even with that awful 27% on pull-up threes, Dennis Smith would have made about 33%. So that's a meaningful jump, about over a percentage point from what he did. And so you expect improvement there. Also, shifting Dirk out of the starting lineup should help Smith a little bit defensively, just because they'll have better fallback options. Not that they're playing great defensive power forwards or anything like that, but if he can make the transition, the parallel here might be kind of like Jamal Murray, where it took him a year to really kind of figure out where things were, and also Jokic really established himself in a role, so Murray had to do a little bit less. And again, I might be a year early, but I think he'll be much better this year.
Yeah, I did not pick him for that reason, and what the chemistry is going to be between he and Luka Doncic, certainly the way they're raving about Doncic, it seems like he's going to be number one there in the pecking order, and we'll see. Smith's game doesn't jump out at me. I agree with you that his shot selection could have been better, but his game doesn't jump out at me as someone who, you know, gets a lot more efficient with lower usage. You know, I think he kind of is what he is in that respect, but hopefully they'll run more, which I think would be huge for him. Certainly I expect him to take a leap and to still look good this year, but I wasn't quite willing to put him on there yet. But I don't disagree with the theory of what you're saying. This is one actually that as a veteran jumped out to me, and that's Eric Bledsoe. Really
interesting.
You know, my theory is that the Bucks are going to be a lot better this year. Eric Bledsoe, you know, I think the thought was before he came to the Bucks that he was a top 15 point guard, maybe even a top 12 point guard in the league, and I think Dip Bledsoe has always had great defensive talent, but really just struggled mentally, especially in that series against Boston. And so I think that Bledsoe, with the beauty of what Coach Bud is going to bring them, I think it's just more consistent execution. I think that Bledsoe, especially defensively, is going to be able to take a major step forward this year. He looked pretty good athletically. He had probably an underrated regular season as the Bucks made their playoff push. And then, you know, there's really, in terms of what the perception of him is, a little bit of a stink on him because he played so poorly, made so many mistakes in that Celtics series. But I think Coach Bud can help him cut down on those. They are going to play with a lot more spacing on this Bucks team with Brook Lopez at center. Bledsoe is going to be able to get to the basket, physically overwhelm smaller point guards. We see that Bud, the way they move the ball. Bledsoe is a guy who physically is very good, but doesn't have a ton of moves. And so that means that Bud, the way they move the ball from side to side, get guys moving with an advantage, get guys in the blender. I mean, that's where Quinn Snyder kind of got a lot of those concepts, was from Coach Bud. And so playing with space, being able to catch the ball on the move on the second side, get right into the lane with that overwhelming physicality that he has, I think he can have a really, really good year this season. And, you know, I think we'll be talking about him in a different way at the end of this year, I believe, assuming that he can stay healthy, which he did all of last
year. I thought about putting Malcolm Brogdon on this list for very similar reasons, in case Eric Bledsoe disappoints, that Brogdon, you know, could get back to that level and actually maybe push Bledsoe out a little bit, just because Bledsoe's they're both free agents this coming year, and he's going to be demanding money as an unrestricted free agent. And the other one, we're recording this on Wednesday during the day. I'm very excited to watch Milwaukee. Milwaukee's game tonight might be the single preseason game I'm most excited to see, that or Dallas, one of their games, to see Luka. And one of the other elements is Giannis, because I still feel like there's untapped potential with Giannis offensively and defensively. And so Bud gets in that, I think there's another level that he can go up. Might not be fair to call him a breakout candidate, because I mean, I had Giannis in the MVP discussion for most of last season, but I thought about it. My next guy is Jeremy Lamb. Jeremy Lamb's age 26 season. And the big reason why is because James Borrego, the new head coach, has been playing him as a starter. And what that means for Jeremy Lamb is that he can play more consistently with Kemba Walker. And as a supporting talent, this is actually kind of a parallel with Ennis and somebody else I'm going to talk about as my fourth guy. Supporting talents, who they play with, especially at the point guard, primary ball handler job, is incredibly important, because they get better shots. It changes their opportunities. And so Lamb, if he starts for the Hornets, will be not only playing with a superior point guard, but also generally with a more spaced floor and just more cogent kind of lineups out there. And with what Brego wants to run a little bit more, which is definitely good, and shoot more. So Lamb, for example, last year, he did have a much lower usage when Kemba was on the floor, but he was a more efficient player. And obviously their offense was much better, because their offense was a dumpster fire when Kemba Walker was down the floor. So I think this could be a good year for him. I like Jeremy Lamb. I've liked him for a long time. And I think defensively, they could fit in a little bit better, because they were going with these weird lineups with MKG and Batum and Marvin all together. And so those guys can all play, but it didn't fit perfectly. And I think Lamb could actually make those lineups fit a little bit better, because MKG was a little bit of kind of like a hat on a hat defensively, and then offensively had all those negatives.
Yeah, it looks like his role is going to be reduced. I think that is an interesting one. And Lamb quietly played better. That's something that Spencer Percy talked about a lot when we did the Hornets preview. My next guy is going to be another one of these guys who was great last year, but, you know, I think could ascend to even another plane. And that's Nikola Jokic, that now is the unquestioned leader of the Nuggets offense, recipient of that near max contract. He's got a few incentives in there. But the way that he played in the last month of the season a year ago, now granted those stats are always a little bit fluky, but he's looked amazing in preseason so far, again, against a Lakers team that doesn't really have anyone to slow him down. But I think the way he shot the ball from 3-point range, you know, he's on pace to have maybe the best passing career ever as a big man. I mean, just, he was averaging 6 assists down the end of last year. And I think he is going to get into the post even more now as the rest of the league gets smaller. Yeah, he might struggle a little bit more defensively, but offensively, I mean, I think he's just primed for a monster year. While they're probably not going to play guys who are as limited offensively around him, you know, I think Will Barton starting also, their starting lineup with Will Barton looked awesome. You know, they may not stop anybody with that lineup again, but I think just Will Barton is such an upgrade offensively over Wilson Chandler. And, you know, certainly Jokic is someone who I think has continued to grow from being kind of a league pass favorite and advanced stats favorite into really arriving more in the popular consciousness. And I think, you know, his conventional stats, I think he's going to be well over 20 points a game this year, going to get 10 rebounds, 6 assists. I mean, that's going to be just a nasty player, even by the conventional statistics, and I think people will have a better understanding. We'll see where the Nuggets end up here. I'm a little lower on some of their competition in the West than a lot of people, and so if the Nuggets are in competition for the 3 seed, probably maybe more, Utah's substantially ahead of them, but I think they've got just about as good a chance of anyone of getting the 4 seed, and if that's the case, I think we'll be talking about Jokic much differently.
That's a really good call. I mean, he was an absolute monster at the end of last year. Adam Marius talked about that when we did the Northwest Division podcast for Real Jam Radio, and I hadn't heard the stats at that point, and it just knocked my socks off. It just how good, I'd watched a lot of those games, of course, but just how great he had been, and maybe not to that extent, but there's no reason to believe that could continue. I didn't put him on my list, but I thought about Ben Simmons for kind of a similar reason. I mean, he was a remarkable player for a lot of last year, and generally really good players when they're really young get a lot better. That's the way it works. It's not a fluke. I didn't end up putting him on, but same logic. My last guy, this parallels a lot of the other guys that I've picked. Josh Hart, age 23 season. This is one of my favorite things that I pulled in a long time. Last season, Josh Hart played 564 minutes with Jordan Clarkson, 332 minutes with Tyler Ennis, 207 with Alex Caruso, and just 224 minutes with Lonzo Ball. So as a dependent offensive talent, and he can do more with the ball in his hands than we give him credit for, he hasn't had the opportunity, and he had a pretty efficient year, 40% on threes, basically 60% true shooting, but he's going to get the opportunity to play with some of the best distributors in the entire league. Luke Walton looks like they're going to go, and Josh Hart is a absolutely perfect fit for what they're trying to do, can kind of fill in the spaces that they need at the two guard position. I like him a lot better as a fit, obviously, than Lance, and then KCP, it's going to depend on what KCP we see. So I really like Josh Hart. I think he'll eventually be the starter. He might even start as the starter, which would be really exciting for me.
He started the last preseason game.
He did. And so I'm a big believer in Hart. I think he's a perfect fit. So he's my breakout guy.
Yeah. And most encouraging to me about him is just the number of 3-point attempts he's getting up. He took 8 threes in that preseason game. He's not playing all those minutes with starters, obviously. My last guy is Willy Hernan Gomez. Someone completely forgotten about, traded to Charlotte for 2 first round picks, still has another 2 years left on that contract he signed as a second rounder, essentially at the minimum. But with Cody Zeller, always an injury risk, probably going to be limited in the number of minutes he can play. If Hernan Gomez is a wonderful pick and roll player, he's been stretching it out to 3, having a very efficient preseason so far. Certainly defensive limitations are there, but it sounds like Borrego, another guy who's just going to be encouraging his team to bomb, to run. And so there'll be a lot of possessions available. And to the extent that Hernan Gomez, he can either go in and feast on opposing backup centers offensively, or if he becomes the primary pick and roll guy with Kemba Walker, he could be a real beneficiary there as well. Doesn't really have any competition at backup center unless you want to count Bismack Biyombo, which I don't particularly. And so he had a really nice summer league. He's just, I think, someone that's been forgotten about, but a guy who at a minimum can give you Enes Kanter production with maybe, if not different defense physically, a little smarter defense than Enes Kanter can give you. And so I think, we might be talking about Hernan Gomez, especially if Zeller misses time. Again, he's supposedly healthy with the knee, but it's always a question mark how durable Zeller can be. We could be talking about Hernan Gomez as a legitimate starting center by the end of this year. And certainly when you consider like how off the radar he has been, I would consider that a breakout.
I would too. And I watched a fair portion of both of their games against the Celtics over the last few days. And one of the things that struck me in both of those games was Billy. And I just kept on saying, like, why isn't he a locked in part of this rotation? Because he was doing a really nice job offensively. And then defensively, he was, not amazing, but doing a good enough job. And, they made the move to bring back Bismack Biyombo. And there are certainly things that Biyombo can do. But Hernan Gomez, they gave up, I think, 2 seconds to get him during the middle of last season. I really like that pick. A couple other guys that I want to mention. Jordan Bell. I mean, I thought he was the best center on the Warriors last year. Well, I mean, David West is a little bit complicated, but I thought Jordan Bell was...
I think Kerr is going to screw him again.
He might. He very well might.
Especially in the regular season, might not be... We talked about them maybe doing this with McCaw, but McCaw ended up screwing himself last year by playing really poorly. But you could just see if they hold down his minutes just so that he's not too expensive next year. I mean, that could be part of it, so they can keep him around. It'll be a restricted free agent.
Yeah.
But hey, at least they had that 1 year of Nick Young rather than giving Bell a 3-year contract.
The other guy on the Bucks we talked about, you brought up Eric Bledsoe, which I think is a good choice. This would be a really nice year for Thon Maker to break out. He could be a nice fit for what the Bucks want to do defensively, and then offensively, just somebody else who can space the floor would be very useful for them. He's in an honorable mention. And then another guy, I was reading Sirit Sohi's piece on kind of the Raptors gelling and everything like that, and she talked about how Nurse's system was going to give more agency to the bigger guys, and it reminded me of how much Pascal Siakam improved last year. And I was shocked at how much more complete of basketball player he was last year than the year before. And so I wanted to mention him because if he can take any semblance of that kind of improvement again, he could be an even bigger part of this team. And I even was toying with the idea last night of whether he might end up being the fifth guy in their closing lineup. I think it's possible he's there by the end of this year.
Yeah, certainly if they go with the switch everything approach. And I also expect Valanciunas to have a good year with all the other threats that they have on the scene, the way they'll be.
He had some nice plays yesterday. Yeah. They were playing, he was going into some of those battles and you're sitting there with Gobert like, oh God, like he's going to get swallowed up. And he's, you know, Valanciunas understands how much space he needs. And, you know, he's not perfect. He doesn't fit in with what I love in a center moving forward in the modern NBA. But yeah, he could have a nice year. A
few other guys that come to mind for me, Montrezl Harrell, I think could be this Clips starting center, or at least their closing center by the end of the year. Juancho Hernan Gomez has had some moments early on, a guy that we liked and then just had really a totally off the radar second year, in part due to that mono that he had early on. Not inconceivable to me that he could surpass Trey Lyles and also get some time as a backup three. Wayne Selden, someone I've always liked. Unclear exactly how that starting shooting guard position is going to shake out in Memphis, but I like him the most of those players. Alfred Payton certainly is one who comes to mind. Has not played on a team with any kind of spacing. This will be the best coach that he's had in his career. And I mean, with AD and Mirotic in the starting lineup, Drew Holiday around him, Etuan Moore, another good shooter, I think it's a great chance, you know, pushing the ball in transition the way they did last year. I think it's if he can't succeed in this situation, he just doesn't have the talent. But I think, you know, he could put up, certainly at least in terms of the box score stats, a pretty nice year. We'll see whether they can get him to defend or not. And this is going to be a breakout considering the heights that he's reached in his career. But I do think that Carmelo Anthony is going to shoot it a lot better than he did last year. It was somewhat inexplicable that he shot as poorly on open shots as he did last year. And I think he can at least improve there. And he's going to have, you know, this doesn't mean that he's going to be, you know, a panacea for them or that he should be playing late in games, but he can have a better year than he had last year.
I want to mention one more guy, and I was watching some of the Cavs-Celtics game yesterday, and David Nwaba, I could absolutely see him starting by the end of this year for the Cavs. Like, I just love the effort he plays with. He's not a perfect player by any means.
His skill set on the wing.
Right, and so he could end up, because there's the line between like 3-and-D small forward and just between being a starter and being like a valuable rotation player and being, it's still fuzzy to me, and he could be a really interesting test case for that, especially because he's basically the only guy who does that on their roster.
All right, we'll talk about our regression candidates here, but one reason I'm happy to get home is to burrow into my burrow couch. And while I hope that we do not move from the house that we bought around this time last year, if we had to, moving that couch would be exceedingly easy. It's modular, it's fully customizable, it took me about 5 minutes to put it together by myself, and therefore you can take it apart and put it back together. It makes it really easy to move in and out of any space, and everything is personalized to you. The arm height, sofa color, leg material, size. We've got a love seat, but if we wanted to put it in a larger area, it'd be easy to grab another piece and make it three people wide instead of two. It's the only sofa that grows with you and fits with your life. There's a USB charger for when you're binge watching, you look down and your phone's almost dead. You can go ahead and charge it as well, just right there in the couch. It's pretty awesome. Their website is exceedingly easy to use, exceedingly easy to customize everything, and that site is burrow.com/capspace. Easy to remember, /capspace. We talk about it all the time in the program. That's burrow.com/capspace. You can get $75 off your Burrow sofa. Once again, $75 off your Burrow sofa at burrow.com/capspace. Burrow furniture that's fit for modern life at home. Okay, let's make people angry with our regression candidate.
Well, I'll probably make people less angry because mine aren't really star players. It's just guys that I thought of that aren't going to be the same as they were. I don't care about appeal necessarily in this. But the first guy I thought of, and it's sad because I like him a lot, is Anthony Tolliver. So this is going to be his age 33 season. Last year, he shot 44% on threes with the highest three-point attempt rate of his career, and his age 32 was also the highest full season usage of his career. And now he's going to a team that doesn't necessarily use his skill set as well. I mean, we've seen Tibbs kind of battle with this, whereas Stan Van Gundy was very comfortable with the three-point shooting power forward. And also something that's concerning about Tolliver is that his defensive rebound percentage was just 12.3% last year. And that's, you know, Minnesota has centers. It's not like he's going to be asked to do that, but that would be a problem depending on how they kind of have the Jimmy Butler situation resolves and what they're getting from their guards as rebounders. If you have a power forward who's just not providing much value there, it could be problematic.
I'm going to start with someone who I really like as a player and was absolutely key to his team's success a year ago, but as a ground-bound power forward who is reliant on switching and also shot basically the best of his career from three-point range a season ago when you consider both the volume and percentage. I'm a little worried about PJ Tucker, especially because they don't have now as many guys on the wing. Is he going to be pressed into guarding the best guy on the wing now, as instead of being more of a help defender? If he has to do that, I don't think he has quite quick enough feet at his age, 33 season, to do that any longer. You wonder a little bit about his shooting again. Quietly did not have that great of a PER last year either. Can he make shots above the break? You know, he shot better from the corners. Is he going to be able to stay healthy at his age? How many minutes is he going to have to play? There's a guy who, you know, doesn't have, he's someone that I really like a lot as a player. I hope that I am wrong about this, but someone who they're kind of just counting on here to be as good as he was last year. And at his age, his pedigree, going to be 33, it's a little bit concerning to me that, you know, they're, because he's the type of player and at the type of age where you can drop off a cliff a little bit and just be unplayable offensively and just be a little bit too slow to really stay in front of guys on switches. He's always going to have that big body. He's an excellent post defender, but, you know, if he gets switched out on to say, you know, a Steph Curry, is he going to be able to guard him? You know, is he going to be able to stay in front of some of the quickest guys in that switching scheme? You know, that could end up being a little bit of a question mark. And is he going to be able to bring that same incredible energy late in games on the offensive glass? Just mostly age related here. It's a concern because I think he had a wonderful year last year and some regression could be coming.
Well, yeah. And he only played, I mean, so 27 minutes per game last year. And that was close to the career high for him. He has been in the 30s before, but it had been a little while since he did that as a member of the Phoenix Suns. And so that's a little bit of a concern too. And with PJ Tucker, this is something that gets talked about all the time and it really pisses me off. People like who don't rely on their athleticism, and so they go, oh, well, it's not as big a deal if they get slower. No, it matters a lot because there are certain thresholds that if you can't meet that anymore, then you just become unplayable. Dirk is a really obvious example of this where, yeah, he was kind of patching it together for a while and then he just became unplayable defensively basically because of losing that half step. I think of Paul Pierce is another example here. And PJ Tucker could easily fit into that conversation.
Who's your next one?
My next one, another guy that I like, but Wayne Ellington, you'll hear this from me a couple times. Anytime a guy has the best season of his career and it's after the age of 30, I'm always a little bit skeptical. And Ellington compounds a couple of those concerns because he derives so much of his value as a three-point shooter. Do you happen to remember? Because it stunned me just how extreme this was. Do you know what his three-point attempt rate was last year?
Like per 36 minutes?
No. The proportion of his shots that were threes.
Oh, God. Probably like 85%. But and his three-point attempt rate per 36 minutes, I think he was like over 10 attempts per 36 minutes, which is, you know, that's a very valuable player. But I could certainly see some regression coming there.
Yeah, so exactly. So he was 10.2 per 36 and it was 83% of his shots were three-pointers last year. So any downtick there, I mean, he doesn't get to the free throw line. He doesn't get to the basket. He does everything there. And so while I loved what Wayne Ellington brought last year, I thought they should have played him more. It's so hard when what you do is one thing because even if he shoots like 37% on threes, that's still a pretty significant drop in value because that's all he does. So that's concerning to me.
Yeah, and he takes some very difficult attempts. I mean, I think a lot of his value too just comes from the fact that you really have to guard him and stick with him coming off of those.
Well, and his activity, he'll provide value even if his shot isn't going in as much. But and also I could see him getting more lost in the shuffle. Remember, Dion Waiters missed so much of last year, and we don't know exactly when he's going to come back. And we don't know what's going on, if they're going to get Jimmy Butler or something else. But I don't know. I am a little concerned.
My next guy, speaking of Jimmy Butler, is Jimmy Butler. Going to be 30 this season and coming off of knee surgery. A guy who athletically, to me, has not looked quite as good being guys one-on-one. Certainly in that Houston series, he was coming back from the knee surgery, but we'll see where he's at. Obviously, probably going to be on a different team, but not having a training camp with that team. He's also someone who is kind of hard to fit in with him offensively because, you know, he likes likes to play with the ball in his hands. He plays at a pretty deliberate pace, not a great spot-up shooter, not a great guy playing a role. And just at his age, with the athleticism on the decline, coming off of surgery, he's going to feel a lot of pressure as well going into this contract year. You could see him starting to take some more bad shots, not being as efficient as he had been. So he's someone who just comes to mind for me as someone. The other thing to remember too is just how ridiculous he was last year. You know, I mean, I think this overstates his impact, or maybe not his impact, but may overstate how good he is. But he was fourth in the NBA in RPM last year. A lot of that came on the defensive end. He's not going to have nearly as crappy defensive teammates, probably no matter where he gets traded to this year. And, you know, 2.78 out of that, his 6.39 RPM came on the defensive end. So I don't expect his impact stats to be as good. I don't expect his efficiency to be quite as good this year. And I think that coming off the surgery, all those Tibbs miles on him, that we could see him fall back to being an effective player, but not someone who's in the conversation for a top 10 player in the NBA anymore.
I don't want to step on your toes if you included him, but I thought of putting on LaMarcus Aldridge for almost exactly the same reason. Like, he could have a good year and just not have as good a year as he had.
Yeah, no, I mean, we talked about that. I didn't have him on my list, but it's certainly someone that you could bring to mind. I do have another Spur on the list, however. I will let you go next here. I'll tease that.
My next one might be controversial, and it's not a full, like, oh, he's going to take a big step back, but I'm concerned about Andre Drummond because his role is going to shift a lot. I was very surprised and encouraged by how much he was able to do with the ball in his hands last year. And a stat that I found was that he had a 16.7 assist percentage last year without Blake Griffin on the floor, which was most of last year. And then that dropped to 4.6% when he played with Blake, just because you're obviously going to have a point guard with those guys. And so there just isn't enough basketball for everybody. And Griffin's ahead of him in the pecking order more often. And Drummond can be useful as a kind of a smaller role guy, but I'm concerned about that. And then the other thing is also Griffin inconsistent as a shooter, so maybe that leads to just more congestion in the lane. Also, Detroit's perimeter rotation still makes me a little bit queasy. And Drummond's defense, it's not all the way there for me yet. So it's not necessarily like, oh, he's going to necessarily be worse than he was last year, but I'm a little bit on alert with him.
Yeah, I could see that if Reggie Jackson isn't healthy, and they've got Ish Smith out there as well, you know, just to not have the shooting around he and Griffin, it could be difficult. My next guy is DeMar DeRozan, someone who, I mean, I think just in the conventional wisdom, he's been a clear all-star in the East these last few years. The West certainly will be much harder going for him. So in terms of making the all-star team, you may not see that. But worth noting that Toronto was fifth in the NBA in terms of percentage of their shots as threes last year. San Antonio was 26th in the NBA in terms of percentage of their shots as threes. Toronto actually had underrated spacing last year, I believe. And DeRozan also took 20% of his shots as threes after under 10% the previous year. Actually got to the rim more last year, despite his advancing age, in part because they had better spacing. And San Antonio, at least among teams that figure to be decent, might have the worst spacing in the NBA this year, and they're probably going to play a traditional center most of the time. The guys who can shoot can't really defend, so how often are they going to play? DeJounte Murray's mid-range jumper has looked better, but you know, I don't see him being an off-ball guy shooting the ball. Greg Popovich, really, you know, with Aldridge, with DeRozan, don't see him spacing the floor a ton. He's been more reliant on ISOs and post-ups, but he doesn't really even try to, like, get a ton of mismatches too. I don't, like, DeRozan can punish mismatches in the post, but not necessarily guys who have more size than him. So I think he's just going into a much more difficult offensive ecosystem this year as he gets up into his late 20s, and he's not in a system now, despite Popovich's brilliance, that really encourages taking the right shots offensively. So I think that his percentage of shots as threes is going to backslide this year, and that he's just not going to have the space to work the way he did a year ago, and that's going to be a problem. I think he's had metronomic consistency in terms of his true shooting. He's been basically right at the league average, 55% the last few years. One of his big strengths is not turning it over, but I expect his true shooting to be below the league average this year, and you know that we won't necessarily be talking about him the way we were in Toronto, in part too because he's in the West.
That's an interesting call. I totally understand it, and the rationale is sound. As I mentioned when we did the West over-under Spurs Magic, I'm a little bit there, but in terms of the mechanics of it, you're completely right. My last one is not actually a player, it is a unit, and that is I am really skeptical of Indiana's defense.
Huh.
And last so they ended up 12th last year And that in and of itself is surprising. But one of those big things is that they gave up the fifth most threes by proportion of shots, about 34%. But opponents made less than 35%. And that was one of the worst numbers in the league. And when I watched the Pacers, I didn't really see anything in their profile that was leading me to go, like the Celtics, let's say, they're pretty consistently good at contesting threes. And even then, there isn't as much control over it from the people who have looked at this in a larger point. But then the other elements of it that are concerning for me, they're a bad defensive rebounding team. I don't really expect that to change. Like, Myles Turner is not going to figure out how to defensive rebound.
If he's a player that I really like. Four more, I think it could improve. But yeah, if it's Thaddeus Young and Turner, that might be the worst defensive rebounding.
So that's a limitation. Victor Oladipo is going to get turnovers. He's an absolute steal monster. And also, I think they're going to be playing more guys in their rotation that aren't necessarily zealous defenders. You know, Tyreek has his moments to be sure, but like Doug McDermott, I'm not really a supporter there. And then if they go bigger, that doesn't necessarily help them because then it makes them a little bit less versatile. So I'm not saying they're going to be like bottom 10 necessarily, but if that drops off a little bit, and then the guy that I almost mentioned, and I'll just kind of do it as a 4A and a 4B considering it's the same team, is I talked about this in 15 and 60s last year, but Victor Oladipo after the All-Star break was still a very valuable player. But here's what happened. So he went from being a 60% true shooting player on 30% usage before the All-Star break to 53% true shooting on 31 usage. And so if you want to think about that as a proxy, it's kind of like going from what Kyrie Irving is as an offensive player to what John Wall was last year as an offensive player. And that's a pretty significant difference. I think he's probably closer to what he was pre-break, but even a small step back would be significant for Indiana because they're thinking about how to build around Victor Oladipo. And so they need to figure out what is he on both ends. And I love Victor Oladipo. I'm super impressed with him. But if it's not quite what that was, they probably want a more complete point guard next to him for the long term.
Yeah, I think I'm a little higher on Oladipo than you are at this point. I just really think that he can, I don't know if build on last year is the way to put it necessarily. I think he can get some more refinement to his game because he just has this nuclear athleticism with the ball in his hands and incredible burst. And then if he can refine that a little more, I actually kind of like him more as just a point guard, and that they could really upgrade their defense by playing him at the one and then just getting more size. But my last guy is going to be Kevin Love, and he's going to be in a totally different role this year. You know, maybe superficially his stats will be better, but he shot some career highs last year. Not quite a career high, but in Cleveland, he'd basically been right at 37% from three. He was at 42% last year, although remember, he didn't play that many games or minutes. He was only 28 minutes a game last year. Also shot 62% at the rim. Again, they had a ton of spacing. LeBron obviously was setting him up there a lot. He's going to be receiving a lot more defensive attention now without LeBron on the floor. He's going to be 30 this year. Also, big time health concerns with concussions, knee surgeries, and he's just going to have to take a lot more bad shots this season. So I'm very skeptical of this Minnesota Love idea. I mean, I think he's a valuable offensive player to be sure, but I think he's going to struggle defensively as well. He's going to have to play more minutes. I'm not sure he's going to be able to hold up there or not. I mean, he basically has been 31 minutes a game in his Cleveland career, and as I mentioned, down to 28 last year. And defensively, there are major concerns. So I think he might be an all-star this year just because the East is weak and he is shooting a ton, and he has the all-star pedigree, so he's just in people's minds. But, you know, I don't really expect him to be effective as the number one offensive option that he's going to have to be this.
If you're right, that would be absolutely devastating for the Cavs long-term because they just paid him all this money. And part of the reason you and I were really critical of that was because they paid him like this experiment worked, and we have absolutely no idea whether or not it will. A couple other guys I want to mention. I feel like this might be the year that Goran Dragic fades off a little bit, especially because he struggled a lot playing with Wade. They might stagger those guys. I think they'll try to a lot, but I mean, offensively, he's so much better with the ball in his hands, and then defensively, you know, whenever guys start getting into from their early to mid 30s, it becomes a concern. Bobby Portis, I like him a lot better as a center than a power forward, and now they have Wendell Carter and Robin Lopez, at least for now, so I don't think he's going to play a lot of center. I think that's going to hurt him a fair amount.
Although he's going to shoot every moment he has a chance to when he is on the floor.
For damn sure.
He took Drew Holiday, 19 shots in 21 minutes in that first preseason.
That's right. So Drew had the best offensive season of his career. I'm always, you know, that's always a little bit concerning. I still think he's an awesome player. I think he'll have a good year, but maybe if he takes a little bit of a step back, they will miss Rondo in that capacity if he became more aggressive as a scorer. And I think Trevor Ariza is, he might have a higher volume, so his numbers might look good, but but I'm guessing he'll be substantially less efficient just because he goes from the funhouse mirror that is the Houston Rockets to a team that we're not even really sure what they're doing at point guard. So that'll be a pretty big adjustment for him. And, you know, defensively, how does he adapt from being on a championship contender to being on a team that is more in the maybe in the like best case scenario, they're outside, like just on the outside of the playoff mix. Like that might affect the way he approaches each game defensively. I don't know. Hopefully he's more zealous, but it can always be a challenge.
Yeah, the one I would add is Tyreke Evans. I think he can still be a valuable player, and he was so good last year in Memphis that even if he drops off, he can still be well worth that contract that he got in Indiana, the 1 year, $12 million. But I think that Tyreke just is not going to shoot the ball as well this year as he did last year. And, you know, health has always been a concern for him, and he might have struggled again with health last year. Although health has actually been fine for him anytime he hasn't been with the Pelicans training staff. So maybe that's an overblown concern, but didn't play that many games last year just due to tanking purposes and being shut down. So I think both in terms of health and his 3-point percentage that protected him from a potential regression last year. And so we might see that come again this year, even if, you know, I think he's still going to be an effective player.
Here's a crazy Tyreke Evans shooting stat. So he's a career 32% 3-point shooter. He has three total seasons over 35%, and he has three total seasons under 25% or under.
That's pretty remarkable. But I guess all that time when he was hurt, he had time to work on his 3-point shot.
Well, and I mean, in Sacramento, they weren't really encouraging that, and those teams were just such a mess. So, I mean, a lot of that was that. Though that year on the Pelicans, which is also a small sample size, he only attempted, so the first year he was on the Pels, he only attempted 95 threes the entire season, despite playing 2,000 minutes.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the league has certainly changed, but, I mean, he deserves a lot of credit for improving his 3-point shot. It was something that was, I mean, going back to college, was it considered a huge week. Alright, should we do real quickly here, since we're running short on time, our best bet?
Yeah, so I already mentioned my first one, so that's Utah's over. I think that they're going to be really good. My second is the Knicks under, especially with the potential reporting that Porzingis might be on the later end of his projection, and I think they'll be super patient with him, and he's the most important player on their team. Or do you want me to do all of them, or do you want to go back and forth?
No, I think we can go back and forth. I also had the Knicks under for the same reason that you mentioned, although I'm sad that we weren't able to get that when it was 30.5. This is actually one that we disagree on that I have as a best bet, and that is the LA Clippers over. I mean, I kind of did it just straight from the variance between my prediction and what the over-under was, and I predicted the Clippers to win 42, and their over-under was 38, so I was, well, probably got to do that one. Yeah, I think they just have too much talent. I think their offense is too good, and they're going to be trying to win, so I think I like that one. Utah, I feel good about, but I wasn't quite willing to go there. I did go with my third pick for the Houston over of 56. I think there's just too much talent on this team. They just have too good of a system. There's just so many of these teams just have absolutely no way to deal with their pick and roll ability. So I like that Houston over.
I do too, but it's not my number three pick. My number three is Toronto's over. I think they have so much talent on this team. The idea of the bench mob is still true. They can go with a lot of different closing fives. And even I thought Kawhi looked good. I watched him last night against the Jazz. I thought he looked close to what I hope he's going to be. Yeah. And so if they can get that, then that's even better. But I mean, Toronto, I think they're a better team than this number. So that I feel good about that one.
Yeah, I had the Toronto over as one of mine as well. I'm not putting mine in any particular order, by the way.
Oh, okay. Mine are in order. So it's Toronto. Is that your next one?
So go ahead.
Okay. So mine is Chicago's under. I don't believe in their defense, and that's a big problem. And then offensively, it could work. It could not work, but that kind of uncertainty. I mean, one of the big challenges, and this came in on my fifth one too, is there just weren't that many clear cut things on the board. So I started getting into ones that I felt pretty good about, and usually they would never make it this far, but those are the best things on the board.
Yeah. So we've got all of mine. I guess you've got one more here still.
Yeah. And mine one is a holdover from yours too, which is Houston's over. So we have a lot of really similar ones here.
What are our Houston. Only difference? It's going to be Clips over
Clippers in Utah.
Oh God. We have all the other four are exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man. That's depressing.
It is.
Groupthink.
Well, I mean, but we had more differences in the over unders this year. So we can focus on that instead.
Yeah. We did have seven differences. That's about normal for us, isn't it?
Or it might be. I honestly don't know.
I'll have to go back and look at some point, which I won't remember to do because we have to end the show right now. Please don't forget about our sponsors, Ancestry and Burrow. Use those /Capspace URLs. Let them know that you came from us. And anything else that we should not forget about, Danny?
I'll plug my big series is going to start coming out for The Athletic. I don't know what teams we're starting with. I think it'll it'll start coming out on Thursday. So that's going to be, I'm doing 30 kind of hybrid 2019 offseason preview and season previews. Those are coming out. And I will have, between this and the next Dunked On, I will have a Real GM Radio coming out with guests that is not only to be announced, to be determined.
Yeah. And if you aren't familiar with Ben Taylor, by the way, and you don't know who he is, he's just done amazing work, probably the best work of anyone that I've seen on historical ranking of NBA players. We talked about his top eight extensively yesterday, but if you didn't listen to that because like, oh, Ben Taylor, who the hell is this in the title? He's awesome. Please listen to it. All right. Talk to y'all later.